everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 287. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is This Show Is So Gay. And of course, go to the Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have such a fun show for you this week. We must get started with our guest. Well, if you were watching the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade on Thanksgiving, as I did, then you were one of the 22.6 million people that heard Did you not even know that, William?
No.
We'll get to that. I got to introduce you first, but 22.6 million people watching this week's guest. So amazing. William Blake is a New York City cabaret star. As an actor, his regional theater credits include The Who's Tommy, Chicago, and The Rocky Horror Show, for which he won the 2006 Column Award for Best Supporting Actor. In 2004, William released his first studio album, and shortly after that release, he auditioned for the fourth season of American Idol and went on to compete in Hollywood. He's performed all over New York City at all the big haunts like Don't Tell Mamas, The Duplex, The Metropolitan Room, so many more. In June of 2012, he and music director Michael Thomas Murray enjoyed a sold-out engagement at Birdland presenting Echoes of Etta, a tribute to Etta James, which won just a freaking ton of awards, His second album, William Blake, Live from New York City, was recorded at that same legendary Birdland Club to a sold-out audience. And oh yeah, did I mention the part where he was on a float singing on Thanksgiving to 22.6 million people? William Blake, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much for having me.
22.6 million people.
That is ridiculous.
We'll get there. We'll save that for a second. Let's start where we would start. Let's start with Texas, right? We have quite the Texas upbringing. Talk to us about life in Dallas. You know, Texas sometimes gets a bad rap for not being the most gay-friendly place around.
Well, I got to tell you, I had a great upbringing. I grew up in Dallas, and then my parents divorced when I was 12, and then we moved to Plano, which is a suburb of a suburb. And I graduated in 2001 at Plano East Senior High School, and it was a very large graduating class. And they were the support of the arts in that school. It was so amazing,
nice.
And so I felt very fortunate to have gone to that school and to really be able to branch out and do the things that I like doing, like singing, like acting, and have it be just so accepted by everybody, you know, the jocks, the science nerds, and I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, it's just such a great art school. So I loved growing up in Texas. It was amazing. Great theater program, great theater community as well that I was very active in since I was 9 years old. So I really attribute all of my, I guess, training, if you will, to doing that.
What was the star turn in high school? What was the part that, you know, you just exploded?
Oh, goodness gracious. I did something called Sound Invention, which was our vocal pop jazz group.
Gotcha.
And, you know, where we just took all of these, like, popular songs and made them these choral arrangements that were done by such jazz greats like Garmin Meter and people from Manhattan Transfer and whatnot. And so that's where I really got to shine as a guest soloist or what have you. It was so much fun, and it was just great training. It really was.
Nice. Went on to Southern Methodist University.
I did. I went there for 2 years. I did end up leaving because I was getting more work as a singer.
Nice.
And then I, of course, went on to do American Idol. And so I just needed to refocus my energy a little bit. I just don't think I was really prepared to go straight from high school into college.
Yeah.
But I don't regret the move. I thought it was a good move on my part. That's what happened with that.
How do you wrap your mind around the American Idol experience?
Well, here's the deal. There were so many people that wanted me to audition for that show. Now, I was not a fan of the show, necessarily.
Okay.
I did not watch the show. I don't think I'll get in any trouble for saying
that. No, you'll be fine.
I never really watched the show, but I did do the show just so people would stop telling me to do it, you know? I was just like, oh, please, if I do it, will you shut up? Will you please? And, you know, my mother was actually, she was the one that said, this is what we'll do. We'll go to Orlando first, and if you don't make it in Orlando, we'll go to New Orleans. And so we did. And she said, I'll pay for it. It's no problem. And I was 22 at the time. And so we went to Orlando. I didn't advance at all. And then New Orleans, I just kept advancing and kept advancing, and we just had to keep, you know, getting another hotel room and say, oh, we need another night because, you know, he's still going. And, you know, and finally, you know, it was the three judges plus the guest judge was Gene Simmons, who I got to see again at the 88th Annual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade.
Yes, you did.
So I was just like, remember me? Of course, you know, I didn't really get to talk to him. But so it was an interesting experience. You know, reality TV, they kind of, because you have to sign this huge contract, and they kind of own you for a little bit.
Okay.
And it's not the best feeling in the world. But once that year was up, I was able to sort of start continuing my growth as a performer. And I, you know, I got a lot of great work out of it. But
yeah.
Yep, I've been there. I've done that. I will never do reality TV again. Like, now people are saying you should do The Voice and America's Got Talent. I said, no, stop. No, done it. It's over. No more reality TV. I can't do it.
I want a Real Housewives of the Duplex. That would be amazing.
Oh, see, listen, I am down for that. I'm a character. I know that's for sure.
I love it.
I think people would watch.
I would be all kinds of tuned in on that one. Now, you made the move, as so many of our guests have made over the past 7 years of doing the show. We
yes.
love hearing about that move to New York City. What was going through your mind?
Well, I was, you know, I had pretty much done everything that I possibly could have done in Texas, you know, where I was from, and I was just ready for the bigger, better city and you know, the city of opportunities. And I saved some money, and I moved. My first apartment was in Inwood, which for all the listeners out there that don't know Manhattan or how it works, it's, Inwood is as far north as you can go.
Oh, yeah.
On the A or the C line, or I guess you could take the one train as well, but it's way the heck up there, but it's quiet and they're big apartments and it's cheap.
There you go.
So it was, and so that was my first apartment. And then I've moved so many times while I've lived here, but my first job was at Don't Tell Mamas from about 2007 to 2008. I worked there, and you know, the owners sort of changed hands, and I decided to leave. And
yeah.
then I bartended for a year and a half, and then I ran a restaurant in Great Neck, Long Island for about a year. And then finally, for the last 4.5 years, up until June 1st, I was the assistant GM of Birdland Jazz Club.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, very instrumental, that club, to really get me to where I am today, because, you know, they gave me my first club gig, where, you know, I could finally say I'm making my New York Cabaret debut.
Yeah.
In one of the best venues on the face of the planet. Johnny Valenti runs such a great club, and I couldn't have been prouder to work there, but I did work there full time, and then I was getting gigs on the side, and it just got to be really difficult to balance it.
Right.
So I did end up making the decision to leave. So since then, I've just continued performing and, you know, the appearances and things, and then I also just started working at the Duplex.
Love.
Which is one of the, you know, 60 years, over 60 years in operation, one of the best piano bars in the city, bar none, great cabaret room, and a great group of people. And it's part-time, and it's not, I don't have to devote so much energy to the job. Well, I mean, of course, at work I do devote a lot of energy, because it's an energetic place to work, and you're singing your butt off, and you're slinging drinks, and that's the name of the game. But it's just so great to be able to go to work someplace and not feel so obligated. And then being able to do my freelance performances and you know, studio gigs and stuff like that on the side, it's really, you know, I'm in a good place right now.
Nice. Nice.
So, yeah.
Well, we only had the opportunity to talk about the cabaret scene a handful of times over, you know, the mm-hmm. past 7 years. Talk to us about New York City cabaret. What's going on these days that has you excited? How would you describe it for our listening audience?
The New York cabaret experience is, it's it's very, very special. You know, you go to into places like Downtown Mama's and the Duplex and the Metropolitan Room, and for, you know, an hour or an hour and 10 minutes, you get to be captivated by a performer, you know, that is only utilizing, you know, a rhythm section, sometimes just piano, and they get to really share what makes them tick and how what songs really speak to them. And I think it's great as a fellow performer to go and support. I try to as much as I can. It's really difficult, but because there's so much cabaret in the city. But
right.
It's really wonderful to see what makes people who they are,
yeah,
as performers and you know, their craft. And so, but it's been going on for so long now, you know, the Manhattan Association of Cabarets and Clubs, the MAC Awards and things like that. You know, they recognize annually, I guess for the last 30 years, artists who have really made a difference in the year that they were nominated. And Mike and I were, Michael Thomas Murray and I were so fortunate that we got a phone call from Lenny Watts that we were nominated for Show of the Year with our Etta James tribute. And to win that award, it meant so much.
Amazing.
To both of us. Because we did work very hard, but it was a show that has catapulted us into. I mean, it's like we've created a monster with this show.
Yeah.
It's really a dream, you know, to be in the cabaret community like this, and to work and to fill up Birdland and fill up Joe's Pub. I think we've done it 8 times, and we've had sold out houses, numerous times. So it's great. I guess the thing about cabaret is it's about the intimacy. It's about sharing, and you know, you kind of make this contract with people in the dark, and it's fulfilling.
And I don't want to be crass, but I also want to highlight, because we've certainly talked about this a bunch, it's also affordable. Like, it's not,
yeah,
you know, you can go and see this entertainment, whereas Broadway is just kind of pricing people out, as good as stuff is on Broadway. Cabaret, mm-hmm, is much more accessible, and you can still see that same level of talent.
There's so many talented people out there that are doing these small rooms.
Yeah.
And they're impressive. These performers are impressive, and I'm so happy to call so many of them my friends. They're also my colleagues, but they're friends, and to have such a wonderful just grouping of talented friends is a blessing. But yeah, you're right. I mean, you spend $250 to go see It's Only a Play with Megan Mullally,
right,
and Matthew Broderick, and you know, sometimes I think someone told me they spent $500 so that they could sit in the front row for Neil Patrick Harris and Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Now listen, I haven't seen the show. A lot of people that I know have seen the show and said that he was fantastic. He was the number one thing on Broadway, and good on him. But to go and hear somebody like Marilyn May, whom is, you know, in her 80s, still singing her butt off at the Metropolitan Room, taking requests and nailing it every single night.
Yeah.
I'll go see Marilyn before I go see Neil Patrick Harris. Thanks.
That's like a whole Cleveland mortgage payment for me to go see Neil Patrick Harris in one of these shows.
I'm not even joking, man. I mean, $500 so they could sit in the front row, and I guess, like, I don't know what happens really in the show, but I think he, like, sits on people's laps and is, you know, very, you know, well, he's not in the show anymore. So.
Yeah.
But he did win the Tony. Congratulations to him. It's night and day, you know.
Absolutely.
We got Neil Patrick Harris, and we have Anne Hampton Calloway, Marilyn May, all these people that I look up to so much.
Yeah.
I'd opt for them.
Well, talk to me a little bit about that wonderful world of piano bars. I was actually just telling a friend the other day, you know, look, mm-hmm, I kind of grew up in New York City during that piano bar time of just being, mm-hmm, in my early 20s, in the late 90s, and there were just so many that you could go to, and now there's not as many, but you're there at the Duplex. I remember working at the Duplex with my buddy Kate Pizzakis, and
yeah,
we would just,
I love her.
Oh, just a doll, just a total doll, and she would even let me be seen more every now and then, so it was fun. But what always amazed me, and what I don't think people understand, is that people just walk in off the street, and sometimes they're really good.
Yes.
That's crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just like when I first moved here, you know, I walked into the duplex and I walked into Mama's and I walked into Helen's and Brandy's and I wanted to show why I moved here. And there's so many people that come in that think they've got talent or they know they have talent and they come in and they perform at these piano bars and get up to a mic and with somebody that they've never met before in their life behind the piano. But the piano players are always so great at what they do. I mean, they've, you know, nowadays it's with iPads, they've got so much of a library that they can use from. They can just, everything's become so much more accessible, I suppose. But, yeah, it's true. You get impressed. I've become, enamored with a performer that I don't know that's just, you know, visiting. From another part of the country or another part of the world, and they'll just make my mouth drop, and I'll go, sing! Oh, sing! Oh, my gosh! And I'll throw my shoe at them. You know, I mean, it never ceases to amaze me. It really does.
We will give you the opportunity to do what Brian Nash did previously on our show. If there are any two songs that you could ban from here on out that people are no longer allowed to sing there at the Duplex, what would you ban? William Blake, Cabaret Star.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. There is a long list.
Only two. Only two.
Okay. All right. Goodness gracious. Okay. So I think right now, because it's so requested, I don't ever want to sing Let It Go from Frozen ever again.
There you go. That's number one. I hear that.
Okay. And if I have to hear Neil Diamond's Sweet Caroline one more time, I'm going to poke my eye out with the Duplex pen. I can't. Either one of those. Just trash them.
We will add that to the list of Don't Stop Believin' provided by Brian Nash.
Oh, yes.
It's fun.
I mean, I'm not a piano player. I'm just a singer, but I know that those guys have Piano Man has got to be on the top of that list.
It's got to be up there.
You know, I mean, and like walking in Memphis, and they're like, oh, you know. Oh, I'm so sorry. Can I curse? I'm sorry.
We'll bleep it. Don't worry.
Oh, okay. for me as a singer, Let It Go. For me, just being in the piano bar, Sweet Caroline, I can't stand that.
Nice. Before we leave it behind, I really do want to highlight, because I have to tell you, it's one of the things I miss most about not being in New York City anymore. There is a real sense of community in those piano bars that you can't find in other places.
You're right. I think it's a great team. Of people that, you know, that we get to work with, and we are a team. You know, at the end of the night, we're helping each other out, and we're supporting one another. And it's you don't get that in most places. I mean, you would hope that you would get that anywhere you worked, that wonderful sense of community and togetherness. But sometimes people aren't so lucky. I happen to be a very lucky person.
Yeah. As bad as someone's day gets, you just turn on Maria Gentile's Kindness Makes Me Cry, and you realize, oh, my day's not that bad, so it can't be that bad.
I have no idea how much I love that woman and her music. She's tremendous.
Love her.
I'm working with her tonight.
Look at that. Tell her we said hi. We miss her.
I will.
All right, we got to flash forward. How on earth did you end up on a float in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade?
All right, well, I got to tell you, Michael and I and our group with the Etta James Show, we did the show at the Carlisle in a late-night slot in April of last year. And it just so happened that Amy Kuhl, who was the parade master, you probably saw her on TV at the beginning, Cutting the Ribbon, which she had that gorgeous pink coat on, and
she did.
So adorable. She's so adorable. I love her to death. So anyway, she was there, and she said, okay, I have something for you, but you're probably going to have to wait until next year, and it's good. So I said, okay. And then I got, I think it was in February of this year, I got a phone call from Bill Skimmerhorn, who is one of the head honchos of the parade, the head honcho. And he's an Emmy Award winner. He's like a big kid. He loves doing this all of these parade functions. I mean, I'm flying to Orlando on Friday to do the holiday parade because I did the track for them. So anyway, I'm moving too far ahead. So anyway, I met with him in his office for about 45 minutes, and we were just talking about all the mutual friends that we had in common and the music that we had in common. And he said, "Well, are you doing a show? I heard you're doing a show this week." And I said, "Yep, I'm doing it. I'll get you tickets to come see Echo Zavetta at Joe's Pub." He came to see it. And then I got a phone call the next day, and he said, "I've got two things for you. Number one, I want you to record for the holiday parade that Macy's does for Universal Studios Orlando." So I recorded that in July. And then he said, "And I hope you're sitting down. We want you to do the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade with you, Mike, and your Peaches," which is our three backup singers, our gorgeous backup singers, Ashley, Shira, and Stephanie. And I put the phone down, and I did a little dance, and then I picked it up, and I said, "What time?" He said, just circle November 27th in your calendar, 2014, yeah, around 7-ish in the morning. And I said, "Don't worry, I won't plan anything that day." And that's how I got it. That's how we got it. That's how we got to do the parade. So, and then Matthew Sklar, who wrote Elf musical and was a Tony nominated composer for Wedding Singer, did the music. Bill actually wrote the lyrics. Those really cute lyrics: "Slice up the turkey, pour on the gravy. I like my cranberry sauce on the side." Somebody like did a vine of that particular phrase, and it was tweeted to me, and I'm like, "That's funny." But it was, it's such a cute song, and it was totally our bag, very R&B. Michael did the arrangement for the NBC Universal band, which was six horns, guitar, it was just a really great sound. And then we went in and did then we did the parade. It was just dream come true.
Let me set the stage for folks. If you haven't seen it, I don't understand, because 22.6 million people did see it. You're on a float. It's a boat, right? It's a boat theme. You got Miss USA over your back left hand shoulder.
Yes, Gina Sanchez. Yes, 2014.
She's just waving. Right behind you is the Ronald McDonald big balloon.
Right, right.
Is there an element of the surreal happening here?
What do you think? First of all, the adrenaline rush was insane. It was insanity, but you're almost afraid. Oh God, I hope we don't miss our cue.
Right.
Because right when we're moving into that performance area, right in front of Macy's.
Yeah.
The song started to play, and I'm like, oh crap. And the girl heard it too, and so I knew I heard it, and I was like, okay, all right, we're good. And then once that, of course I went and saw the video as soon as we could get home. I was like, oh good, no one messed up. Oh good. Oh, thank you, Jesus. There is definitely an element of surreal. There's some, Megan Trainor was in a float ahead of us, and we kept shouting, "Megan! Megan, we're over here!" And the kids on my float wanted to be on a Megan Trainor float. I mean, they were like, they were not having me. They were like, "Who is this guy? No one knows who this is. Megan, we're over here!" It was surreal. And the cast of Annie was on our bus with us and Pentatonix was on the bus. It was surreal. Of course it was. It was further from surreal. It was inexplicably, I can't even find a word appropriate for it. It was mind-blowing.
Was there not a part of you, though, that wanted, because I felt like, can I be critical for a second? I would like to say that I would have appreciated had you gone all out. I wanted to see an eye patch. I wanted a parrot over your shoulder. I wanted, the full-on pirate on the boat Thanksgiving experience.
Well, I didn't want to take anything away from the pirates and the Peter Pan.
All right. I'm just putting that out there.
Thank you for the criticism. the float was the Mary and Carol showboat, so it probably would have been more appropriate to have done something, like Tom Sawyer, Huckleberry.
I guess.
I don't know.
Maybe some Old Man River. I don't know, but I just felt like there was more than your beautiful coat and scarf that we could have featured. I'm just putting that out there.
Okay. Well, you know, I loved that scarf, and I wanted to show off the sweater because the sweater matched the scarf. And, you know, it doesn't get much gayer than that.
I love it.
Within that scarf, because that was a big gay scarf. But no, I didn't want to do anything too costumey. I wanted to be comfortable. You know, I layered up. I did, you know, I had thermals on. The only thing I wish I had done was if I had doubled up on socks because my feet were freaking cold.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
Yeah, I thought they were going to fall off.
Is it fair to say that the response has been a little bit overwhelming?
It's not overwhelming as
good
as it is just so, no, not overwhelming. I would say it's been so, it's, again, just blessings. It's just, it's good. I'm so thankful for people to have been calling me and,
yeah,
and leaving messages on my Facebook, tweeting me, putting things on Instagram, all that stuff. Oh, and by the way, at Willie B. Singer, that's my Twitter handle.
Yes,
and,
love it.
WilliamBlakeSings.com, that's my website. But yeah, it's that the response from people has it's not been overwhelming as much as it's been a real blessing.
Nice. Okay, so next up, you're headed out to Florida, get some different weather.
Yeah, hopefully good, great weather with my dear friend Jennifer. And we're going to be opening the holiday parade because my voice is featured in their track, I guess, for their choreography and for their parade. So they're flying us down. We can't wait. And we're going to go to Hogwarts and have some of that. What is that called? The
butterbeer. You'll have some
butterbeer. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're going to have some butterbeer. And, I'm very excited to be doing that. And then, of course, we come back to life, back to reality, and I go back to work at the duplex that Monday. And God only knows what's next. I know that we'll be doing the Etta James show in Connecticut in January. And hopefully other opportunities will come, within the next couple of weeks. But, for now, I'm just sort of still floating on cloud nine.
As you should be.
Yeah, and I'm trying to not let ego take over. I'm just trying to just take it all in as good.
Well, look, there's going to be so much more to come. Listeners, you can stroll on over to WilliamBlakeSings.com to learn all about everything about William Blake. His Twitter handle is Willie B. Singer, and you can, of course, find him on Facebook. I was sitting there with my two nieces, ages 9, ages 10. They watched the parade every single year, and you came on, and I said to them, I'm like, you know what? That's like one of us, because they're two little cabaret singers right there. And when I saw you and I saw the peaches, it was just kind of like, oh, that's this whole slice of community that I so want to see represented, and I felt such a kinship with you. And honestly, I was so proud of you, William. It was just so incredible.
You. Oh, that is so kind. Thank you so much.
So
it was really great to be representing like that. It was awesome.
We were happy to have you there.
That's the way I do cabaret, honey. I do it big and I do it loud, and we do it with R&B and we do it with class. So,
love it. Love it. WilliamBlakeSings.com. Everyone, William Blake, so excited for so much more from you coming up.
Thank you so much.
Well, we have oodles and oodles of time to go over this week's latest LGBT news. I'm going to fly solo on this one. Becca's actually performing tonight. Our very own Becca is in a storytelling show, so I will certainly be going to go hear her here in Cleveland, along with her brother Adam, who hosts the show. It's called Keep Talking. I've performed in it a few times. If you're ever here the first Wednesday of the month in Cleveland at the Happy Dog, which is such such a fun place. You have to go see Adam hosting this storytelling event where, for the month of December, Becca's performing tonight. So she's off prepping her story, so I'm going to do the gay news on my own. I will take a second to respond to some of the emails. First, thank you so much for all the compliments that we got. We got just a ton of emails about last week's show, and gosh, that was a real treat for me, and a real Thanksgiving episode to speak to the Reverend Eileen Brownell. A treat, an absolute treat, so I'm thrilled that she connected with you all and our chat resonated in that way. I've also gotten three or four emails of folks saying, why haven't I covered the story about, I don't even know how you pronounce their name, are they the Duggars, the Duggars, the folks who are on the reality show who have like 100 children who put out there that people should post their pictures of them kissing, of couples kissing, so then some same-sex couples posted pictures of them kissing, and apparently the Duggars or the Duggars and their 100 children took one of the posts down, and they were supporting some anti-LGBT causes with their money. I don't know. I don't really feel this is a big story, and I know that it's very much aflame there at the Balearico Project and with John Becker, because I think a picture of John Becker and his partner was one of the same-sex couples kissing that got taken down. Sure, let's not support the Duggars or the Duggars and their 100 children, but let's also not give this too much attention because these are very much not important people. So, yeah. Not really thought leaders here in the society, kind of the same way I feel about the Duck Dynasty thing. I just don't really care. I don't really care. Because there are other fun things to care about. I love, this is my favorite story of the week. If you did not see this, it came out of Australia. It was covered in The Advocate. A transgender teen in Australia has a super supportive mother. This mother placed a birth announcement in her local newspaper to announce that the previous birth announcement, you know, the one that was placed 19 years ago, was in error. This is what the announcement read, quote, "In 1995, we announced the arrival of our Sprocket Elizabeth Ann as a daughter. Oops, our bad. We would like to present our wonderful son, Kai Bogert. Loving you is the easiest thing in the world. Tidy your room." How cute is that? In an interview with that newspaper this week, the mother, Yolanda Bogert, said placing the ad was a no-brainer. Kai came out to her as transgender just a few days ago, although she had seen signs that told her that this was a possibility, but the mother wanted to show him, her son, and the rest of the world that she supports him unequivocally. Kai said he has yet to make a decision about hormone treatment or surgery, but he now feels, quote, more me than I was a few days ago. He expressed gratitude to his mother, telling the Courier Mail newspaper, quote, I am so happy with what she has done. This is a mother putting out a new birth announcement. I love that. That is an amazing story. That is an amazing story. So take heed, everyone. Take heed. On the other side of the trans spectrum, in newspapers, and my gosh, as diametrically opposed as it could be to this mother in Australia taking out this crazy supportive announcement for her trans son, we look at an ad in Minnesota. The discussion about how to best protect transgender student athletes in Minnesota's high schools is set to resume this week, and despite 2 months of cooling off time, one side in the debate is roaring back, full speed ahead, and guns blazing. That side is represented by a conservative group based in Minnesota that is well known for its opposition to new guidelines that would apply to students across Minnesota and put the state in compliance with a U.S. Department of Education update to Title IX requirements. That update extends the law's civil rights protections to all students, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity. Readers of this past Sunday's edition of the Minneapolis Star Tribune couldn't help but see, and you guys have to go see this, because you really, it's something to behold. It was a full-page color ad in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. In the main section, it features a young woman of high school age dressed to play baseball, but warming the bench instead of standing in the batter's box. The idea is that she's off the team because a transgender student took her place. That's the idea behind it. So there's a headline of the ad that reads, "The End of Girls' Sports?" And the text reads, "Her dream of a scholarship shattered. Your 14-year-old daughter just lost her position on an all-girls team to a male," the ad states. And then they do the fear-mongering, because that's not enough. First, they're just putting out there, hey, your daughter, she's going to lose her star turn on your team because a male's going to take her place. But then they take it one step further with the ad. The ad reads, quote, "And she may have to shower with him. Are you willing to let that happen?" This is a full-page ad. It was purchased by the name of the group, which I haven't said yet, is the Child Protection League Action, which describes itself on its website as a 501c4 nonprofit corporation that is committed to promoting the welfare of children and protecting them from exploitation, indoctrination, God, we don't hear that word enough, and violence. The Child Protection League Action educates the public and public officials, lobbies elected lawmakers, and equips its members to impact public policies and legislation toward the physical, mental, and emotional safety and welfare of our children. So they're trying to protect the children from indoctrination, which you have to assume is from the gays. So yeah, first of all, only the best people are going to be on the team. So Title IX requires that we let people try out. It doesn't guarantee certain spots for certain people. It guarantees that there's equal access. That's what Title IX is all about. Second of all, no, your child is not going to have to shower with someone against their will of the opposite gender. I think they missed the whole point about transgender. Kind of the whole thing. The Advocate reached out to the Star Tribune for a comment. A senior editor at the newspaper said the newsroom had received no complaints thus far. Once Minnesota media critic David Brower tweeted about the ad, the Twitterverse lit up. At least one subscriber told the Advocate this second transphobic ad was just too much for her to tolerate and that she would be calling to cancel her subscription. Reaction on Facebook likewise has been swift and negative, as comments focused on the ad's campaign attempt to inspire fear of transgender people, calling the effort sick, disgusting, and shameful. That's all out there. In response to the ad, Kirsten Hart wrote in a forum for parents of transgender children, quote, "My child is a risk to no one." So there you go. Going on in Minnesota, you have on one hand, you have a mother, an amazing mother there in Australia, Yolanda Bogert, putting out a new birth announcement for her son. And on the other side, you look at Minnesota, and you have the Child Protection League Action, which that's not even a very good name, folks. It's not even a good acronym. They're putting out there some just good old-fashioned fear-mongering. Good old-fashioned fear-mongering. So there's that. Staying with the idea of youth, but we're going to look from Minnesota a little bit north to Canada. When two sixth-grade girls at St. George Catholic School in Ottawa were charged with completing a project for a social justice fair, they wanted to focus on gay rights. But when the principal put the kibosh on that topic, the mother of one of the students pointed out the obvious irony. Yes, that would be some obvious irony. Anne Maloney, who is one of the mothers, said, quote, "They've learned more about social justice in a week than they ever could have done by doing a project. It's been very real for them." Maloney said the principal expressed concern about the age appropriateness of the topic, as well as possible reactions from anti-LGBT parents. The Citizen, the Ottawa Citizen newspaper, reports that the principal's decision is now under scrutiny from the school board, with board chairman Ted Hurley saying the principal's concerns were solely about age appropriateness and not about the proposed topic itself. According to the Citizen newspaper, Hurley plans to invite the two students, Quinn Maloney Tavares and Polly Hamilton, love Polly, and their parents to a meeting to discuss the project. Presumably, they'll have to reach a decision soon, as the social justice fair is slated for January. These two girls need to finish their project, folks. The Citizen ran an editorial that skewered the school's assertions that the project raised any red flags regarding age appropriateness at a fair for 4th to 6th graders. Here's an excerpt from that editorial. I gotta read this. It's great. Quote, "The idea that gay rights is a topic inappropriate for grade 4 and 5 students is a puzzler. What does that say to the students of that age with same-sex parents? The idea that a child too young for the birds and bees talk can't understand that daddy loves daddy makes no more sense than saying a child can't understand that mommy loves daddy. It's ludicrous and a reflection of old, bigoted attitudes. It's a pernicious idea that to talk about gay people's civil rights in a social justice context involves talk of sexuality, while talk of straight people's civil rights does not." It's a great editorial there in the Ottawa Citizen. So we got Australia, we got Minnesota, we got Canada, and we also have a musical break. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back at you with more news.
Another year you made a promise, another chance to turn it all around. And do not save this for tomorrow, embrace the past and you can live for now. And I will give the world to
holiday story, a heartwarming holiday story coming at you from the beautiful and scenic Tempe, Arizona, where a Baptist pastor has told us all that we could possibly have an AIDS-free world by Christmas. An AIDS-free world by Christmas. A Baptist pastor in Tempe, Arizona has called for the mass extermination of LGBT people this past Sunday in a sermon entitled AIDS, the Judgment of God. And these YouTube clips have gone all kinds of viral. In the sermon, which was uploaded to YouTube on Monday from Faithful World Baptist Church, Pastor Stephen Anderson said that God has ordered in the scriptures that gays should be killed, and that if humanity wants to have an AIDS-free world by Christmas, he said that's what should be done. He says in the video, quote, and I watched the video. I took the time out of my day to watch the video. He said, quote, turn to Leviticus 20:13, because I actually discovered the cure for AIDS. If man also lie with mankind as he lieth with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood shall be upon them. And that, my friend, is the cure for AIDS. It was right there in the Bible all along. And they're out spending billions of dollars in research and testing. It's curable right there, because if you executed the homos, like any pastor would say, if you executed the homos like God recommends, you wouldn't have all this AIDS running rampant. End quote. Well, gosh, so many fun parts about this sermon. First of all, I love that he acts like he's the first one who's read that line in Leviticus 20:13. He discovered it. He discovered the cure for AIDS. So there's that. I guess the part here, because look, there's any number of pastors out there, there's any number of people out there who espouse just ridiculously anti-gay, horrible, violent, homophobic views. That's nothing new. Nor is it something new that it's a person in power, and this guy certainly has power. I guess what's so striking about this for me is that in 2014, this guy can stand up there and be in front of a congregation and not have one person in the congregation stand up and walk out. You know, not have one person disrupt it. Because maybe someone did walk out. We can't really see that. The video, the camera is only on him. But no one disrupted it. In fact, there were all of these titters of agreement, laughter when he said he found the cure for AIDS, affirmation. And that's what's so bothersome for me. It's not so much the pastor. There's always going to be guys like this pastor. There will always be guys like this pastor. As long as there is Leviticus 20:13, there's always going to be a guy who feels that he has discovered the cure for AIDS. But especially with everything else going on in the world, especially with all of these amazing displays of protest in the face of just ridiculously horrid issues of social justice, and I don't even need to go there because they're all there right now, I kind of want someone to stand up and disrupt the filming of this video. Maybe there's not even people in the video. I think you kind of see one person's head. Maybe it's just a laugh track. Who knows? Who knows? He did say elsewhere in his sermon he had a foot-stomping, shouting tantrum. It was amazing. About the idea that people can be LGBT and Christian. He said there will never be any gays in his church. He said, not ever, ever, ever. This was his quote, no homos, again, that phrase, it's brilliant from a pastor, no homos will ever be allowed in this church as long as I am pastor here. Never say you're crazy. No, you're crazy if you think that there's something wrong with my no homo policy. And my hope, my Kenchneck hope, is that that's written somewhere, that he has a piece of paper, perhaps on a placard, perhaps it is laminated, bronzed, embossed, I don't know. But something that says no homo policy. I just want that to be codified. I want it to be codified. Other sermons from a faithful world have included a meditation on the evils of allowing women to speak in church, and a lengthy discourse, just in time for Hanukkah, on the lying evil ways of Jewish people. That would be the lengthy discourse, Happy Hanukkah, on the lying evil ways of Jewish people. Again, look, this guy's getting press, and I'm sure that he will get donations now. I'm sure just by covering it, not so much on my show, but the way that this has gone viral, I have no doubt this will increase the donations for this church, for the Faithful World Baptist Church there in Tempe, Arizona. That's not, you know, surprising to me in any conceivable way. What's surprising to me is that no one disrupted it. That's what's surprising and even more significant, disappointing. So in other news, of course, you know, it wouldn't be this show So Gay without some sort of marriage equality update. We turn our attention to Florida. A federal appeals court ruled this week they have rejected Attorney General Pam Bondi's request to at least temporarily extend Florida's ban on gay marriage, which then would possibly set the stage for same-sex marriages to start in Florida in January. U.S. District Judge Robert Hinkle in August ruled that the voter-approved ban was unconstitutional, but as all of these judges seem to do, he placed a stay on his decision to allow time for appeals. That stay is expected to expire. Florida Attorney General Bondi last month asked the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals to keep the stay in place until appeals of Hinkle's ruling are finished, but a three-judge panel this week issued a short decision turning down Bondi's request and saying that the stay entered by Hinkle expires at the end of the day on January 5, 2015. The American Civil Liberties Union of Florida, which has represented a group of plaintiffs challenging the ban, they said on Wednesday afternoon that same-sex marriages will be able to start on January 6th if no other attempts at extending the stay are successful. Also on January 6th, same-sex marriages from other states would be recognized in Florida, the ACLU said. They said this quote in a prepared statement, "Today, in denying the state's request to further delay the ruling, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the state's argument that allowing same-sex couples to marry and have their marriages recognized will cause harm to the state and refused to make these families wait any longer. The court effectively ruled that the state does not have a likelihood of succeeding in its appeal." So, of course, the question now is whether Attorney General Pam Bondi chooses to spend more time and more Florida taxpayer money to continue appealing what judges have already ruled on. We suspect that she probably will, because apparently that's a good use of her time. So, yeah. In Major League Baseball, there was a major coming out in Major League Baseball. Now, I am not downplaying the significance of this, but I will tip my hand and say the end of the story, it is not a player. It is not a player. So, although Major League Baseball, unlike the NFL and NBA, is still waiting for its first active player to acknowledge that they are gay, Dale Scott, an umpire, has crossed that threshold and says he has been heartened by what he describes as an environment of acceptance. Dale Scott has been a Major League umpire for the past 29 years. He quietly acknowledged he is gay by submitting a photo of himself and his longtime partner to accompany a November interview with Referee Magazine. I didn't even know there was a Referee Magazine. His story was amplified on Tuesday when Outsports.com published an interview with Scott, who said his sexual orientation has long been acknowledged in umpiring and baseball circles. He said this, quote, "I realize that it could open a Pandora's box, but this is not a surprise to Major League Baseball, the people I work for. It's not a surprise to the umpire staff. Until Mike and I got married last November, he was my same-sex domestic partner, and he had his own Major League Baseball ID and was on my insurance policy. This is not going to be some huge flashing news to Major League Baseball, but I also didn't want to be making some coming out story, some banner headline, because that's not how I operate. It's not a shock to Major League Baseball management because they're well aware of my situation, and it's not a shock to the umpire staff. If it would have been, I don't think I would have done it." Scott has been a crew chief for 12 years, has worked 3 World Series, and was on the crew that worked the Dodgers-Cardinals National League Division Series. He feels going public won't be a surprise to most in the game. I think the most surprising thing to me in that story is that there's a Referee Magazine. As there should be. Everybody should have their own magazine. But I love that there's a Referee Magazine. And finally, I don't know what to do about this story. So, in any other week, this would be my top story because, as loyal listeners of the show know, and new listeners, I'm telling you right now, blood donation is, you know, kind of my prime issue. That's my big thing. That's what I'm all about. I want to get rid of the ban on gay men giving blood. It's crazy. There are people dying. There's a blood shortage in the U.S. And if we lifted the ban on gay men giving blood, there would be much more blood. So, when this story came out this week, you would expect that this would be my top story, and I could spend the whole hour talking about it, but I just don't even know how to make heads or tails of it, and quite frankly, I'm getting a little bit burnt out. That said, government health advisors have concerns about lifting the nation's 31-year-old ban on blood donations from gay and bisexual men, despite growing pressure from gay rights advocates, medical experts, and blood banks. So, just to give you a little backstory, the ban dates from the first years of the AIDS crisis and was intended to protect the U.S. blood supply from exposure to the little-understood disease. That was 31 years ago. But many medical groups, including the American Medical Association, say the policy is no longer supported by science given advances in HIV testing, and gay activists, including Ken Schneck, the host of This Show Is So Gay, say the lifetime ban is discriminatory and perpetuates negative stereotypes against homosexual men. Despite such concerns, blood safety experts this week urged the Food and Drug Administration to exercise caution in making any changes to current policy, saying the impact on the blood supply is difficult to predict. The FDA is not required to follow the recommendations of its advisors. The agency has not set up a timeline for making any changes to current donor standards. So here is what is being advocated now. Now what we are saying is, hey, what if we recommend moving to a 1-year deferral period, which would bar male donors who have had sex with men in the previous 12 months? So that is what this panel is recommending. So instead of having a lifetime ban, we would have a 1-year deferral period, which would bar male donors who have had sex with men in the previous 12 months. Not unsafe sex, not risky sex, just sex. I don't understand how this is possible, and I almost don't even want to make these arguments about why this is not possible, because I feel like this is going to play into some sexualized culture where we're embracing all these stereotypes about gay men. No. Let's just take me for an example. I will speak from the eye. I am a sexual person. Mom, Dad, if you're listening, I am a sexual person. That's me. Okay? Now, should I enter into a situation this weekend? I don't know what this weekend holds. I don't know. I've kind of been seeing someone. He's kind of amazing. It's really not the point of the show, but I've been seeing someone. He's kind of amazing. I don't know what we're doing this weekend. Should it come to pass that we might want to engage in sexual activity, the odds that I am going to say in that moment, now this isn't about getting carried away in the moment, because those are all the arguments about lack of condom usage, and I don't want to go there. That's not the point. You know, people saying, oh, I didn't want to use a condom because I got carried away. No. I am advocating for safe sex. Okay, advocating for safe sex, as I do, as I engage in, all right? Putting that out there. Now, should we be in that moment and decide, hey, we would like to have sex, the odds of me saying, you know what, dude? I'm going to start calling him dude. You know what, dude? I can't, because in December of 2015, I want to give blood. That's what I want to do, so I'm sorry. This is a beautiful moment. What a lovely dinner we had. What a great movie we saw. I see my soul in your eyes. Let's have sex. Those aren't all my prerequisites, but I want to put it out there in case my mom is listening. So yes, all of those things coming to pass and the stars have aligned, but I'm sorry, I can't, because in a year, I would like to give blood. Yeah. Now, that doesn't downplay the fact that I really do want to give blood. I have that blood type that will help all of you. I have that blood type where if I give it, I can save everybody. But the odds that I'm thinking a year in advance, no. I would like to be celibate. I would like to take on a life of celibacy, because can't you give blood like every few months? Some people do that. So say I want to be one of those people, which I kind of do. I love giving blood. I used to love giving blood before I was told I couldn't anymore. So if I want to be one of those people, I now have to take on a life of celibacy? That doesn't seem fair. That seems a conflict between altruism and being a good person and wanting to help the blood supply and being a sexual person. And I shouldn't have to choose between those two things. So, but here's the thing. Even though I've now ranted about it, I almost don't want to keep talking about this. I was going to write a Huffington Post article, but I'm not going to. I'm not writing a piece on this, because now I have to talk about being a sexual person. And I feel like now I'm playing into those stereotypes, and I don't really feel like doing that right now. I'm a little burnt out on this. And I think that's one of those important things that you acknowledge when you're engaged in a life of activism, that there's certain times that you are burnt out on certain issues. This one right this second, I'm feeling a little bit burnt out. This little curveball where I now have to argue that I can be an altruistic person and a sexual person, I'm not up for it right this second. So I'm going to focus my energy on other things, but certainly my hope is that other people take it up, because that's a really unenviable argument to have to put out there without playing into all of these stereotypes and everyone saying, oh, see, they can't abstain from sex. That's the whole problem with those gays. They want to give blood, but they can't even abstain from sex for a year or, you know, forever if they want to keep donating blood. That's the curveball. That is the curveball with this new recommendation, which, by the way, the other reason not even to give it that much time, even though I've given it quite a bit of time right this second, is because it's just a recommendation. The FDA is under no obligation to even take this to heart. So we'll see what even happens with the blood supply. My rant is now over. Hey, our huge, huge thanks to William Blake. He was there on the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. I saw him with my nieces. It was so super cool. 22.6 million people, and you should go check it out on YouTube because it's super fun, and he's got a great scarf. It is a big gay scarf. I will support that. It is. Big gay scarf. So go support everything he's doing. Go check out a cabaret concert. They're super fun. Super fun. If you have the chance to go to a piano bar, I urge you to do so. It's not a karaoke bar. Totally different. Piano bars, totally different. So go check out a piano bar, because there's a great sense of community there. That's all I have for you for this week's episode. You guys get out there. Go use your voice to make a difference in this world, however you know how to use it best for your LGBT and ally brothers and sisters. And of course, while you're making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?